Today, let's start with a summary of what we saw yesterday about matrix public states. And remember that what we're trying to do here is we have a wave function of a lattice system with n sites, and this would be a product basis for the Hilbert space that we have, right? There are d to the n such possible strings. And so what we do is we take these coefficients, we look at those as a tensor with n indices. And then with a matrix product state, what we do is we attempt an expansion of this form. We want to write this wave function, right? This d to the n coefficients as the product of tensors, as a tensor network organized in this way, where you have tensors. Each tensor has three indices, and they are connected in a one-dimensional array. And then we close them. Okay? And we call this matrix product state. In this particular example, this would be matrix product state with periodic boundary conditions. Which we usually call MPS with PVC. So what is this? What's happening here? What does this mean? Well, let's try to remember. So in this case, the tensor network is so simple, or it's much simpler than things we'll see later, that we can still attempt to write this as an equation. So let's do that. So what we are saying is every amplitude, every complex coefficient that we find in this expression here, we can write it as the trace of matrix of a product of matrices. Now, why am I talking about matrices here? So I just told you we have tensors. Tensor A has three indices. It's I that runs from 1 to D. This index is labeling an orthonormal basis on one side of your lattice. And then we have two indices, alpha and beta, right? So imagine for a second that we fix the value of I to say equal, I is equal to 2. Okay. So remember what we said when you have, say, a matrix M with indices alpha, beta, that would be a two-dimensional array of complex numbers. If we say now alpha is equal to 1, what we're saying is we're picking up the first row. Right? And so if alpha is equal to 1, then we're defining some vector v alpha. There is only one index left. Right? So every time we fix an index, we get a tensor with one index less. So here, if we come and fix I to equal to 2, what we get, now we can look at this, say I is equal to 2, and we'll look at this object, and we have a matrix. Matrix, right? So what this means is we have this strange expression here, but every time we fix the indices for the value of the physical indices, say I1 equal to 2 and so on, then what we get are matrices. Instead of three like tensors with three indices, now we have matrices. And what we're saying is that the amplitude for the wave function will come from multiplying or computing the trace of this product of matrices. Okay, this is why we call it matrix product state. Okay, so example. Suppose that we want to extract from this tensor network, suppose that we want to extract how much the amplitude is when we make some random choice of the values for the indices. Okay, so we choose. We now want to understand, well, we have this expression with many coefficients, and now we ask, what's the amplitude that comes here in front of this vector? Okay, so that's a complex number. Now, how are we going to compute this complex number? Well, we'll follow the recipe. So we'll take these matrices, we'll fix them, we'll fix the value of the physical index for A to 1. So that's now a matrix. We'll take value for the physical index for B equal to 1, and so on. And this, the resulting objects are matrices, as we just discussed. And once we have these matrices, we multiply them together, and we take the trace. And of course, the trace of a product of matrices is a complex number. Okay? So that complex number will be the value for this coefficient. And for any choice of values for the physical indices, we'll get a different product or trace of product of matrices. Okay? So when we say this is a matrix product state, what we mean is we can compute all the amplitudes for the wave function from the product or the trace of a product of matrices. Yeah.
Why should it, I think it reasonable for us to be able to represent that psi by periodic boundary conditions rather than Hilbert?
Okay, so why this is a reasonable ansatz? Or why is this part, so first I said, let's assume that we can write the state in this way. Now, this defines a subclass of states. Remember the story about this is our whole Hilbert space, and then for each value of chi, so this space here is d to the n dimensional, and every time we fix the value of chi, we get only some region there. So this could be some given value of chi, we get some. Okay, so now you're asking for this particular choice of tensor network, why are these states interesting? Is that what you're asking?
What I meant was, I'm somewhat familiar with that sort of state. It seems reasonable to represent it by that first tensor network with six indices. Why should I assume that equality? Why would we represent psi by a trace rather than, but by periodic conditions rather than
right.
Open?
So we'll try to build intuition on this later on. Okay. At the moment, just take the idea that this is a representation of a subset of states in your Hilbert space. Okay.
But when you said it's an ansatz, did you give an exact solution?
No. Well, there are states that you can exactly represent in this way, obviously. But this is not the point of tensor networks. It's not about finding exact solutions. It's more of having a tool to address a generic case, not a case that can be exactly solved.
And what sorts of states are exactly represented?
What sort of states? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what we will discuss later on. At the moment, just take this as, well, let's study states that can be written in this way. Okay, why? Well, we'll see later on, right? Okay. Any other question?
I remember last time you mentioned that when you the kind of whole Hilbert space described by this common set you said you took all that, right? For that state.
Yeah, so the dimension of this vector space is very large.
I remember last time, so this chi is presented as MPS.
Right, so here we have a manifold, so a subset of states, which depends only on chi square n d parameters. Okay, so we know that it's like if you have a plane and you discuss a family of subfamily of states that can be, or of points that can be described by a curve, a one-dimensional line, then it's the dimension is smaller, right? So you know that we are not covering a generic case for sure,
yes.
Because it's just a
subset.
Yeah, it's a subset but of zero measure.
Yeah, but I remember last time you said you can enlarge this subset by changing chi.
Right,
chi.
Right. So every time you consider larger chi,
yeah.
you cover more and more. And if you consider chi equal to d to the n half, you can show that you can cover everything. But what we will do is not consider this, but actually a chi that is fixed, that does not depend, this does not depend on n to the zero. Okay, we don't want any dependence on n, chi constant. if we choose chi to be constant, then we have that our representation, the number of parameters only grows linearly in the system size. Okay? We're considering just a subset of states. We are paying a price. We cannot represent, once we fix chi, we cannot represent an arbitrary state. Okay? We can only represent some state if it's contained in this region, which I insist is very small. It's of zero measure. Okay?
The last time you mentioned this, are you changing the power of chi to chi cube, chi four, or you are changing the dimension of chi?
I don't remember what I mentioned last time. Okay? But what I'm saying is the number of parameters we have here is chi square. Okay? All right. So any other question? All right. So then yesterday we started to explore these properties of this subset of states. And what we saw, well, we had these three properties we're going to check on any matrix, on any tensor network. A, is it efficiently, so property A, efficient description. And then property B, efficient computation. Okay. And here we just answer this. We can express a many-body wave function on n sites with this number of parameters. And the cost, so here we are talking about cost of computing, say, a local observable, okay? And we found some expression for the case of we were cheating here. We said this was for open boundary conditions. Where the NPS is written in this way. Okay, why did I do that? Because it's simple to discuss. And in this case, we find that the cost is n chi 3d. But if we instead, so this is open boundary conditions. If we go back to periodic boundary conditions, then you have it in the handout, in some of the figures I gave you yesterday. Then if we were to use these other ansatz, matrix product state with periodic boundary conditions, then the cost would be n chi to the 5, larger power of chi, times d, but still linear in n. Okay? Now, is it clear what's the difference between property A and property B? Can somebody explain what's the difference between having an efficient description and having a description from which, well, which is computationally efficient as well? Exactly, and right. So we could have an efficient description. We saw it the other day with a quantum circuit, where with a number of parameters which might be linear or square of n, you completely specify the wave function. But when you try to compute things with that, properties of this wave function, we don't have an efficient way of doing that. Okay, so these two properties are different. The first one is simpler to satisfy than the second one. Okay. So what we want to do today then is now we have this tensor network. We know how to deal with it. We know that we can efficiently represent states with it. We know that we can efficiently extract information from it. And now we want to build some intuition. That's what Nicole was asking before. What are these states? What do we know about these states? Are these states interesting? Just because you can compute with them doesn't mean that they represent anything of interest to you, right? The question specifically that we want to answer is, do they share properties? Do they look as if they could be good answers for ground states of local Hamiltonians? And what we have in mind is gap Hamiltonians of one-dimensional systems. So what we want to look at now is it's part C, which is properties that follow from the tensor network. So we remember that all these tensors that we have, they are full of coefficients, but we are not going to specify them. In a variational calculation, you would try to choose the best, make the best choice of these coefficients. But here, we won't do that. We want to see properties which just follow naturally from the way the tensors are connected. And in particular, we want to see properties that relate to correlations and properties that relate to entanglement. And what we're going to see is the following. We're going to see that if you start with a matrix product state and you compute a correlator, which is nothing but your matrix product state, then some observable in position 0, some other observable bubble in position L, okay, the expectation value of these two local operators, then we want to see, or we will see, that this decays, let's be a bit ambiguous about what that means, but this decays exponentially with L. We'll see that correlations in a matrix product state, for large L, they decay exponentially. And what do we want about entanglement? Remember, entanglement was the entanglement of a region with the rest of the system. This region has size L. It contains L lattice sites. What we will see is that the entanglement is saturated, it's at most a constant. Okay, that's what we will see as well. And these two properties are in one-to-one correspondence with properties of ground states of gap Hamiltonians. Okay, remember that we studied, if we have a ground state, we have a gap Hamiltonian, then it's ground state, and this is D equal to 1, one special dimension, then the ground state had these properties. We saw that with free fermions. We argued that in terms of also dimer models and so on. But it's something that you see in practice all the time if you study ground states of gap Hamiltonians, which is that the correlators indeed decay exponentially, and that the entropy is saturated, is smaller than some constant. And this, remember, is just a particular case of the boundary law, where D is equal to 1, it's L to the 0. Okay. So what we want to see today is that just because of the way the tensors are connected into a network here, if you the state that you obtain, the wave function that you obtain by multiplying all these matrices together, has properties that match perfectly the ones that you would find in a ground state of a gap system in one dimension. All right? OK, so any question? Good. So now we know what we want to show. Okay? Let's try not to get too lost. The first thing I want to discuss is the following. Suppose that we have translation invariants. So my goal is to study actually an infinite system. Our lattice has infinitely many sides. This will simplify. It will remove any dependence on the size of the system or anything. So suppose that we have translation invariants. Then what that means is that if you translate, if this is translation operator, by one side, so you take your system and you move everything by one side, then imagine that the state that we are describing remains the same, okay? So we have a lattice, we don't have continuous translations, we have to move things by one side, right? Translations are broken to a discrete group, but we still have a discrete group. And now suppose that we have a Hamiltonian that is invariant. It looks the same on every bond. Then the ground state can be translation invariant. And what I'm going to do is, under this condition, I'm going to assume, or I'm going to consider a matrix product state with periodic boundary conditions, where all the tensors that I'm using are copies of the same tensor A. And you can see that if I make this ansatz here, this ansatz is invariant under translations. Okay? A state that can be written in this way, it's automatically invariant under translations.
What about the general phase of the material?
I'm going to assume that has momentum zero momentum. We could assume more things, but let me consider this case. Ground states typically have zero momentum. There might be exceptions, momentum pi or something like this, but under cosgraining you could bring it back to zero momentum. So, but let's restrict our attention to this situation. Okay. So now let's have a look at this. This is very interesting because this construction represents a state. There are n sides here. Okay. So this represents a wave function of that lives in a Hilbert space of n sides. And we have completely characterized it by just one tensor. Okay? So you give me this tensor. And this completely characterizes a many-body wave function. Remember, we were talking here about d to the n coefficients. And now we bring it down to chi squared times d. Okay? So it scales. It doesn't scale with n. Okay? There is no dependence on the description in n. So that's very interesting, right? You thought, OK, I will never understand wave functions of very large systems because there are too many coefficients that I have to deal with. Well, that is not an excuse anymore. Here's a way of writing those wave functions using a number of coefficients that does not depend on the system size. Okay. Now, still, that doesn't mean this is a useful variational class of states, but at least it has this property. We specify some finite amount of parameters, of coefficients, finite number of coefficients. And then we have a description. Given A, you can choose the n. Okay? For any system size, you get a state. OK, so and now what we want to do is to study properties of this type of states. Okay, I said I wanted to study properties of matrix product states. I cheated a little bit. I'm restricting my attention to translation invariant matrix product states. But this is for simplicity again. It's to make things simpler. So we, in particular, once you see that there is no dependence here on the system size, there is nothing that prevents you from thinking, OK, I'm going to consider an infinite system. Okay, and we'll get rid of finite size effects for good. So all the conclusions that we can draw are in the thermodynamic limit. And the only thing that will matter is how large is the distance. What's the distance between the two-point correlator and the two operators? So all the dependence will be in L and also here in the entropy. There is no dependence on the system size anymore. OK, so we're just simplifying things. And now what we want to do is to study, let's start with the correlations. We want to study a correlator. So and this corresponds to figure 6, or well, should have been 7.2, but I made a mistake. So it's figure 6.2 from the figures you got yesterday. All right, so let's start by discussing how to compute the norm of this state. And I'm not interested in computational cost now. I just want to understand the procedure that I would use to compute the norm of this state, because that's what I will need later on to compute a two-point correlator. So the cost, we'll keep track of the cost, but that's not the point. Okay, it's more of the idea that comes with the calculation. So what is this? This is, let's take, what do we have to do? We have our ansatz, it's copies of A. I'm not going to write A every time now. So that would be, imagine that you have n of them, and n, we'll see how to take n to infinite in a minute. OK, so this is what we want to compute, how much this tensor network is. This is a complex, this is a norm, a number, right? So we want to know how much this number is. But Is it clear that what we have here is some structure? Okay, some structure that is repeated many, many times. So we multiply many, many times this structure. So let me then meet front. So let me introduce. Let's look at this object for a second. So this is tensor A. This is its complex conjugate. Okay. And now let's think about this. This is a linear map between this space and that space. So this is like a matrix between the tensor product of these two spaces and into the tensor product of these two spaces. So if we were to compute this together, we will get some. If we multiply these guys together, we get some linear map. I'm going to call this, so you can think of this as a matrix between left and right. Okay, is that clear? We have a composite index made of two indices, but that's one index. You can think of this as another composite index. Okay, so let's call this T. T. Okay? It's a matrix T. And we are going to call it transfer matrix. So is it clear that this expression here, we can rewrite it as this T multiplied many times and then taking the trace of it, that would connect these indices with those, okay? In other words, this is the trace of T to the nth power. Okay, so we take T to the nth power and then we take the trace. This expression here, that's what it is. Okay. All right, so now I need to introduce the eigenvalue decomposition of a matrix. Yes?
How do I know, since you use T to represent the translation operator earlier,
oh.
How do I know?
Right. Yeah, I never thought, okay, so. Not this one. I don't know. This one? So I'm not going to use this operator, this translation operator anymore. Okay? Yeah. I was going to talk about it, not to write something, and indeed, I ended up repeating my notation. All right, so T is a transfer matrix, okay? The normal T. And what we're saying is that we can think of this scalar product as the trace of some transfer matrix to the nth power. And now we want to talk about eigenvalue decomposition. Of some matrix, say T, but it's because we're going to use this one. So the eigenvalue decomposition of a matrix is just, I want to use similar notation to this. Well, doesn't matter. So we can always write a matrix as some eigenvalues, and then write eigenvectors and left eigenvectors. Now, remember this is a generic a matrix. So it's not Hermitian, okay? It's not nice. It's not the nice case where things go nicely in which left and right eigenvectors are the same and so on. So what we have here instead is that this sets of vectors fulfill that they are bi orthonormal bases in that. That's all they fulfill. The left and the right eigenvectors, delta, alpha, beta. Okay, this is the only property they fulfill. So these guys are not orthogonal or orthonormal between themselves or anything. This is the only property they fulfill. But of course, this is nice enough. I mean, this property is alone is enough. So that if we take P and we apply, we multiply, say, the right eigenvector beta, okay, what do we get? We get sum over alpha of lambda alpha, right alpha, left alpha, times R beta. So left times right. Now we come here, and we see, OK, that's a delta, alpha beta. Okay. And so what we get is that this is equal to lambda beta, right beta. So indeed, this is a right eigenvector. Okay, you multiply t times this vector, and you get the vector back with its eigenvalue. Okay. Why do we call these guys left eigenvalues, eigenvectors? Well, for the same reason. We just repeat this calculation, but now we multiply the matrix times this vector on the left. And what do we get? Is we have a delta again here. So this is lambda beta. Okay? That's the eigenvalue decomposition of an arbitrary matrix. Okay? So why do we care so much about this? Well, it will be useful in a minute, but what we are going to do is we're going to assume one thing here. We're going to assume that we have a normalization. So clearly, this trace, we can write it now in terms of the eigenvalues, right? So what we have is that t to the nth power, or let's compute t squared first. T squared, right? You write the eigenvalue decomposition, and you realize that this is, well, let's do it, sum over alpha, left, that's right. Right alpha, left alpha. That's for the first t. Now the second t is sum over beta, lambda beta, right beta, left beta. And now you see that you have a delta alpha beta here. And so you end up with sum over alpha. And the same expression as before, right alpha, left alpha. But now you have lambda squared, lambda alpha to the second power. Okay, that is consistent with everything you know about multiplying matrix times itself. So the idea is these eigenvalues are squared. So in general, now you won't be shocked if we say that t to the n is nothing but sum over alpha of lambda alpha to the nth power. And then here we have the right and the left. Okay? So we are ready to say how much this is. This is nothing but sum over alpha, lambda alpha to the n power. Okay? So if you want to know how much the scalar product of your matrix product state with periodic boundary conditions and is, compute the eigenvalue decomposition of t, and then here you have it. Okay, that's the answer. Take the eigenvalues, take the nth power, make a sum.
So this method is not limited to one dimensional systems.
This method is?
It's not limited to one dimensional Hamiltonian principle. It can be applied to any dimension.
Yes, but what we'll see is that this ansatz matches, so matrix product state matches in a natural way without even specifying variational parameters, properties that are characteristic of ground states in one dimension, ground states of gap systems in one dimension. So you can use it wherever you want, but it has a structural properties that match the ones of ground states of gap systems in one dimension. Okay? All right, so that was that was, now I need to introduce two assumptions, or, well, one is not an assumption. I'm just going to define, I'm going to assume, so this lambda, so we have these eigenvalues of the transfer matrix, and I just consider them to be organized in decreasing order. And for some reason, yeah, here I decided to start the sum at 0. So alpha takes values from 0, 1, 2, and so on. So the eigenvalue decomposition, I just choose it in such a way that the absolute value of these eigenvalues decreases. Okay? They're organized in decreasing order. Now, for large n, what we have is that the largest eigenvalue dominates, right? So we can always, so we have that the trace, well, we have the sum over alpha and the alpha to the nth power, but we can always write this as, so what do we have? Sorry, we have lambda 0 to the nth power plus lambda 1 to the nth power plus lambda 2 to the nth power, etc. But you can always write this as lambda 0 to the nth power of 1 plus lambda 1 to the over lambda 0 to the nth power plus lambda 2 to over lambda 0 to the nth power, etc. Right? And if we are saying that, right, let's leave it like this. And now I'm going to assume the following. This is an assumption. Okay, assume that lambda 0, the absolute value, is larger, strictly larger, than absolute value of lambda 1. So the absolute value of the first eigenvalue is larger than the rest. Then, of course, in this expansion, we realize that what we have are numbers, in general, complex numbers, with modulus smaller than 1, okay, and to the nth power. So if we're interested in the thermodynamic limit, in n going to infinite, all these terms become negligible. Okay? And so what we're saying is that with this assumption, we have that the trace, or if you want the expectation, the norm of your state is lambda 0 to the nth power, okay, plus corrections, which decay exponentially, so plus order, lambda 1 over lambda 0 to the n, where for large n, this decays fast. Sorry, that's not true. It's 1 plus this. Okay, so the dominant term is lambda to the 0. And if this lambda to the 0 is, well, you can actually show that this lambda to the 0 is real. You can show that it will be real. And actually, what we're going to do is, because we want this to be equal to 1, we want the norm of our state to be equal to 1, we're going to take lambda 0 equal to 1. Okay? This you can always do. I mean, if it wasn't, if you had A defined in this way, so and it gives rise to lambda 0 different from 1, then you divide the whole tensor by a square root of lambda 0, and now it's going to be such that lambda 0 is equal to 1. Okay, so that's not an assumption, just a normalization condition. Okay, so what we have then is the largest eigenvalue of this transfer matrix is 1, and the rest of eigenvalues have modulus smaller than 1. And remember, this was an assumption, and there is a lot to be said about this assumption, but it's an assumption, it can be justified later on. So this is the type, so ground state will fulfill this condition quite generally. There are exceptions, but we're not. The exceptions have to do with degenerate ground states, and we don't want to go there. So, okay, so that's what we have, and now with all this, we are ready to understand why correlations decay exponentially in a matrix product state. So. The first step is to look at how much the expectation value of a local observable would be. And again, this is the point. We have already discussed this, how to compute these things, or at least with open boundary conditions. But now we want to do it in such a way that we exploit the translation invariance to get a nice expression for it. So this, what is this? This is, take your, this is the cat. Then we put the tensor, the observable somewhere. And then we draw the bra. Now we are at figure 6.2H, okay? And what we realize here again is that, except for this point here, we have a transfer matrix, our transfer matrix everywhere, right? So this is again our transfer matrix. So we could write this as the trace of t to the n minus 1 power, right? N is the number of sides, and then times something else, which I just draw like this. So what we're trying to do is to compute something of this form. And now what we can do is we can go and take t and write its eigenvalue decomposition. We'll assume again that n is very large. And so what we're doing is we take t to the p power, just some power p, and we discuss that this is equal to sum of like eigenvalues lambda alpha from 0 to whatever we have. And then we have the right eigenvectors, left eigenvectors, and to the p power, so that's going to be to the p power. Now for large, so now we think, okay, for large p on the limit of p going to infinite, we have the limit of p going to infinite. So only the first, remember we have lambda 0 is equal to 1, and the rest of lambdas have modulus smaller than 1. So when you take a very large power of those, you can ignore all of them. And so you can replace this with R0 and F0. Okay? So this is an important substitution. What we are saying is the largest eigenvalue is 1. The rest have modulus smaller than 1. As you consider larger and larger powers of this, all these smaller eigenvalues are multiplied. They become smaller and smaller. Right? In the limit of p going to infinite, these contributions disappear. And we can replace the whole t to the p with, actually this is equal, with this, just the contribution from the dominant left and right eigenvectors. So with that in mind, we can introduce this here. I have in mind that I'm going to take the large n limit that I'm considering an infinite system. And when I do that, I realize, okay, so that's equal to R, the trace of R, 0, so left, right eigenvector, the first, or dominant. Let's call this the dominant eigenvectors. And times this matrix here, okay? So going completely back into tensor network notation, this is the same as this diagram, where this represents, this is the left eigenvector, left dominant eigenvector, and this is the right dominant eigenvector of t. So the conclusion of all this calculation is that once I have the eigenvalue decomposition of t, I can express the expectation value of local observables directly as a small tensor network where you have A here, A star there, and the observable O in here. Right? This is, you know, it took us a few lines to get there, but now we can forget about how we got there. And we just look at the result. What we're saying is that if we have a state psi, which is represented by a tensor, infinitely many copies of a tensor A, the expectation value of local observables can be computed in a very simple way. Build the matrix T, okay? Compute the dominant eigenvectors, left and right eigenvectors, so do the eigenvalue decomposition of T and pick up only the dominant left and right eigenvectors, and put these guys together into this tensor network, which is, you know, what is n here? What is the size of the system? That's the question I want to ask, right? In this calculation, this is the only thing you have to compute. Okay, there is no n. There is no scaling with the system size. All the calculations that we have to do are diagonalize a matrix. This does not depend on the system size. Okay, and compute, multiply these five small tensors together. Okay, so the cost does not depend on n. Okay, so we have not only that we have completely characterized a many-body wave function by means of a single tensor, but actually that we can make calculations even in the thermodynamic limit at a constant cost. Okay. Good, we're almost there, because now we have to repeat this, but when we put two local operators, so that will give us our two-point correlator. Are there questions about this before I jump into the two-point correlator?
About the structure of T, do we know what the upper limit on alpha is?
On what?
On alpha.
Yes, actually, good question. So what we have is T that was built here, right? So this index, this is an index. So what we're saying is we're regarding this as a composite index. But this is alpha, and this is alpha prime. And so this is composite index where alpha goes from 1 to chi, and alpha prime goes from 1 to chi. So this index here, T, these indices go from 1 to chi squared. And because I insisted in calling the first value 0, we'll subtract 1. But it takes chi squared values. Okay, again, independent of system size. So that's just given by the size of your tensors in the matrix product state. Okay, so, yeah.
First, I'd like to make sure that the difference, the difference between the general T, the matrix T, and the Hermitian T is that the left and right eigenvalue are the same object.
Well, if T was Hermitian, then one property in it is that left and right eigenvectors would be the same, and also the if it's Hermitian, then the eigenvalues will be real. You could have a normal matrix, which is that it commutes with its adjoint. Then you would have left and right eigenvectors would be the same, but the eigenvalues would not be constrained to be real. Yeah.
So and also, so here you put the assumption that lambda 0 is greater than lambda 1. Does that mean that does it relate to the ground state?
It does, but I won't. It is so. If you had more than, if this condition was not met, so if lambda 1 was equal to lambda 0, then we would have a case where it's related to a case where a Hamiltonian would have ground state degeneracy. But of course, we haven't talked about Hamiltonians here. Just allow me to just take this assumption as natural, okay? Or if you want, restrict your attention to matrix product states that fulfill this condition. And yeah, that's the subset of matrix product states that we want to analyze. But if we didn't assume this, if this was an equality, then the matrix product state would correspond to another situation where it would be still useful to describe systems where there is ground state degeneracy. But I really don't want to go into details about this.
Just one very quick thing. So here, if you assume that ground state is not
I'm assuming that, so in the thermodynamic limit, that might be true. But the statements that I was making all the way until took n to infinite was general, were correct for any size of the lattice. Yeah. We can discuss more later.
The gap system can have a single constant, so
that is no problem. OK. So let's compute then a two-point correlator, and let's see that the correlations, just from the structure of the tensor network, the correlations will decay exponentially at large distances. So how does a two-point correlator look like? How does it look like? Well, that's figure 6.3 in the notes I gave you yesterday. And so let's first write it. So we are saying we put some operator on side that we call 0, another operator, L sides away. We want to compute this expectation value. We have a way of drawing this. So this would be O, and this will be O prime. Okay, so that's a tensor network representation for this expectation value when we describe the state with a matrix product state. All right, and what we're saying is that there are, from here to here, there are L sides, okay? And the rest is N minus L, but we'll take N to go to infinite. Good, so the first observation is that, well, let's write this as a trace of transfer matrix to the n minus l power. Then actually minus, yeah, that's fine. Minus 1, I guess. Minus 1. Then we have this guy. Then we have, so this is O. Then we have things in the middle, which is, again, the transfer matrix to the L minus 1 power. And then the object for O prime. And we close this. OK. Is it clear how we are going from one place to another? So remember that we have T, transfer matrix, appears here a number of times, L minus 1 times, in this case, L is equal to 3. So this side 0, 1, 2, 3, then there are two power, second power of t. In general, we'll have L minus 1. This power here, this term, corresponds to whatever we have in here. Okay. And then this other term corresponds to whatever we have in here. And in here. All right, is it clear? Is it clear that this expression, this expectation value that we want to compute, when written in terms of a matrix product state, it ends up being the trace of some objects that we have to analyze. But here we have the transfer matrix to a huge power, n is going to be infinite. And here we have the transfer matrix to L minus 1 power. OK? All right, so and now what we're going to do is we're going to replace this part with the eigenvalue decomposition. And we're going to replace this one also with the eigenvalue decomposition. But in this case, we know n is going to be very large or infinite. And so in this particular case, we only need to account for the right and the left eigenvalues, whereas here we'll have to account for the whole thing in principle, lambda alpha. Right alpha, left alpha. OK? All right, that's to the Lth power. Maybe somebody should call Lth minus 1 power. OK, so let me go and rewrite. So let's write a tensor network expression for this and for this. This part here will look like this. Right 0. That's left 0, dominant eigenvectors. And this one here will continue with the mixed notation where this is going to be lambda alpha, L minus 1. And then we'll put this is going to be the right, and this is the left. Okay, I'm using a mixed notation. But you have it all. In this figure, in figure 6.3. So now we are doing linear algebra, so let me speed up a little bit. I explained already the basic steps. Let me just rewrite this. I'm going to take, using the cyclic property of the trace, I'm going to take R0 to the other side, and we're going to end up with the following expression, or something that looks like this. We have, so this is L0. Then here we have this sum of lambda alpha to the alpha minus 1 then we have this expression, okay? I've just taken, I've made this replacement, the large power of t, I replaced it with this right dominant eigenvector and left dominant eigenvector, and I've taken the right one to this side. And what we see is the following. We see, you know, this is, I could also write it, I can write it, let me remind you that these eigenvectors are alpha. So this is the same as sum over alpha of some small tensor network so who is everybody this is left 0 this is right alpha this is left alpha and this is right 0 times this part here lambda alpha to the L minus 1 so This is the expression, again, where we want to stop and have a look. What we're saying is that after some manipulation, we have been able to express the correlator as a function of L as some. This is a complex coefficient. I don't know how much it is, okay? But it's a complex coefficient. This is another complex coefficient, okay? And then we have the dependence on L. It's an eigenvalues of the transfer matrix to the L power minus 1, OK? So everything are numbers except a power lambda alpha, so the eigenvalues of the transfer matrix to the L power. So in the figure in the notes, you can, I just group together some of these constants, and I end up writing this as a first term, which I'm going to neglect. Well, no, I'm not going to neglect. So I end up, you can end up writing this as mu 0 e to the minus L with some correlation length that depends on alpha, where, sorry, this is mu alpha. So we end up with an expression like this. What we see is that a two-point correlator, OK, a two-point correlator for a matrix product state ends up being a sum of exponentially decaying functions in L, okay? And there are some definitions. You have the definitions for what this mu and with this chi of alpha, all these definitions are in figure 6.3. But this is just a way of taking all these complex coefficients and putting them together. So this is what we wanted to see, that if we have a state which has which can be written as a matrix product state, when we look at large distances, okay, there is the largest correlation length, alpha, you take actually alpha, so there will be, what we have is sum of exponentials. For large L, there will be one of them that will dominate over the others, and so this is going to go as exponential of L to this largest correlation length, okay? So what we've seen is this is a structural property. For any choice of tensors in the matrix product state, we'll have a property like this, that the correlators decay exponentially. And if you want more details of the calculation, well, you have figure 6.3 from the figures I gave you yesterday. So, all right. So that's one of the properties that I told you we would see, that correlations decay exponentially. And then there is the other property, namely that the entanglement entropy saturates to a constant. And this one corresponds to figure 6.4. And basically, figure 6.4 tells you how you can split. So maybe I'll draw. So that would be now entropy. So we have we can draw what a projector onto the ground onto psi would look like. I'm going to use periodic boundary conditions MPS for consistency with the previous calculation. So that would be what psi looks like as a projector. And now you want to compute a reduced density matrix, you have to trace some of the psi. So rho for a region, say rho for a subset of the sides, say this three, consists, you obtain it. So let's call this A. Rho of A comes from taking the projector and tracing out the site that you are not interested in, okay? And you get some figure like this. And now, what we want to do is we want to take this object and realize that we can split bra and ket indices. We can split them. We can cut the tensor network into two pieces by only cutting a fixed number of tensors. So this is going to be the cut. Maybe I'll choose another color. So this is how you can cut the upper indices from the lower indices. Okay? I found a way of cutting this object. So we have a density matrix for which we have a tensor network representation. And it looks a bit involved, the tensor network itself. But what I'm saying is that you can deform everything that we have here so that it looks like a big mess with three indices. And that we can actually split the bra and ket indices by only cutting two bone indices, this one and this one. Okay? And so what we argued yesterday that this means that the rank of rho A is at most the dimension of these indices together, so that's chi squared. And it's, right, this is the connectivity between bra and ket. This gives us an upper bound on the rank of rho. And that implies, remember, the entropy was, so the entropy can at most be log 2 of this upper bound. And so this is 2 times log 2 of chi. What we are seeing is that this in this expression, there is no reference to how large the block is. Right? You could consider a very large system. You could consider a very large block L. You will always be able to cut the bra from the ket by cutting only two indices. So this tells you that the rank of this density matrix is at most chi squared. And this implies that the entropy can be at most this amount, 2 times log 2 of chi squared, of chi. So this the entropy of this, the amount of entanglement between the region of these ansatz, of this state, and the rest of the system is at most chi squared, constant. It's a constant. It's independent of L, which is, again, a property that we have for ground states of gap systems in one dimension. Okay? So this is then all the properties we wanted to see about the matrix product state. We've seen, we've introduced some wave function. We've seen some computational properties. It's efficient. It's an efficient representation. We can efficiently compute or extract information from it. And then we've seen two structural properties. We've seen that correlations decay exponentially. For sufficiently large distances. And we've seen that the entropy saturates to a constant. And these two properties are in one-to-one with properties of ground states of one-dimensional systems for gaps Hamiltonians. So that is not to say that this is a good ansatz for those ground states, right? I didn't prove that. I just showed that it has properties in common with those. And then you can go numerically and see that indeed this is an excellent ansatz for ground states in one dimension. So it's a bit late as usual, and I'll stop here. Tomorrow we'll see another tensor network.